Jeremy worried about going after Sally, and I've now got two of you who've said most of it. I will try and pick up on some specific points, and I want to try and target this towards some practical things that might actually happen that would make a difference to the industry and therefore to this problem of antimicrobial resistance. And I was reflecting as Jeremy spoke that his memory of the HIV problem in the 80s, and I was also a junior doctor in London at the time, of course, is also a lesson in terms of how much the industry made a solution quite quickly when it really applied its mind to it. And I think that's an important point to remember. So this is the situation that Sally has laid out, which is a big rise in resistance of organisms, a decrease in the number of big companies working in this area from 18 to 4 here. I don't think that's quite right. I think it's a few more than that now. And a big decrease in the number of approved medicines from something like 20 in 1980 through to one or two in the last couple of years. So there's no question that the ability of industry to make medicines in this space has dramatically reduced. Now, just to put that in a little bit of context, of course, the number of companies has reduced over that time overall because of mergers, so this isn't entirely right. And the number of new medicines overall has also decreased in terms of approvals over that time because of changes in regulatory procedures and so on. So it's not quite as dramatic as this, but this is disproportionate. There's a disproportionate reduction in antibiotic drug discovery and development over the past couple of decades. It's also worth reflecting that actually the problem started in about 1980. So although it looks like it's a problem which has got worse, it probably the era of antibiotic drug discovery and development was really from 1930 something through to 1970, and it stopped somewhere at the end of the 1970s, and it's been getting worse ever since. So why is that? And I think there are three key issues. One is it's actually difficult, and I'll come on to why it's difficult. And as Sally said, it's not impossible, and I think there are some things that need to be done in terms of early science to help with this. The second is it is pretty difficult to do the sorts of clinical trials that are needed in order to get an antibiotic approved, and I'll come back to that point, which is partly clinical complexity and it's partly regulatory. And the third is the point that's been raised, which is what is the incentive for companies to get into this space and get back the money that they put in? So let's just look at the success rate and the question about the science. Is it really difficult? Well, I'm not going to go into the detail of this, but the basic message here is this is from discovery through to approval. If you take something like 10 to 15 to 1, you start with 10 or 15 molecules, one of them's going to get approved. As the average for most areas, it's something like 30 to 1 for an antibiotic. So the data from industry look as though it's about twice as difficult, or maybe a little more than that, in order to get an antibiotic approved. So why is that? Well, there are a number of reasons. The first is there isn't really a problem in terms of asking, are there good antibiotic targets? And actually, one of the problems I think has been people have focused, if you like, on a Fleming-like mentality of going after antibiotic targets, and we'll come back to whether that's the right thing to do in the future. But if you look in the bugs, you can identify genes which are essential for the life of that organism. You can identify targets. However, if you then ask the question, well, how good are you at finding chemicals against it? On the left-hand side, you'll see that for 70 so-called high-throughput screens, which is how we screen lots of compounds to come up with something that's a lead that might turn into a medicine, you can see it's a 7% success rate for us. It was a 6.5% success rate for Pfizer from the published data. And if you go into other therapy areas, you're right up towards 70 or 80% as the chance of ending up with a lead. So it's dramatically more difficult to find a chemical that is appropriate as a lead. Some of that might be because the synthetic chemicals used in libraries are not as good as the natural chemicals which were used in the past, i.e., natural products, but that's definitely not the whole explanation because it's also very difficult to find natural products that do this. So that's number one, why it's difficult. Number two, and this is particularly true for gram-negative bacteria, which are the big burden at the moment. Gram-negative resistance is the massive problem we're all facing. Gram-negatives don't like chemicals. They kick them out very well. They're extremely good at getting rid of them. That's what they do. They live in toxic chemical environments. They're designed to kick chemicals out. It's incredibly difficult to get something in that stays in. And a third reason here, and this is the amount of drug in the blood on the right-hand side here, and the big syringe thing is the amount of drug in the blood you need for an antibiotic compared to the amount of drug you need in the two little ones that you can't see for conventional drugs. You need massive amounts of drug substance to kill bacteria. So I rather naively, when I went into industry, thought it must be pretty easy to make antibiotics because you're not even worrying about the same problem you have with drugs normally, which is hitting a human target. You're hitting a bacterial target. The problem is you're using such massive amounts of drug to do so that you have off-target effects and you end up with a very, very high failure rate for toxicity at every stage of development, much higher than in other areas. So it's incredibly difficult to get the medicine without it also being toxic. Here's an example. This is one of our new class of medicines, so-called topoisomerase inhibitor. You can see it started a long time ago, this program, 1998. You've got to be very, very determined if you want to make an antibiotic. And you can see the history there. We've gone through four compounds, most of them at some point or other. They all look great at the beginning. Most of them have fallen over for genotoxicity, for hepatic toxicity, for testicular toxicity, for ocular toxicity, and we're finally down to one that looks as though it might make it, but actually even that is only going to make it for a rather refined indication, and it doesn't have the gram-negative coverage that we had hoped at the beginning. So that's a sorry tale. I mean, hopefully it ends with an antibiotic, but you can see the problems and the timescale that this involves. So the second area is the complexity of clinical investigation. So you take this real scientific problem of how you actually make a drug, and then you have the question of how you can prove in the clinic that this is something that's valuable. And this has not been easy, and you can imagine in any one company, retaining a skilled clinical development team is difficult. People don't like sitting around hoping that they're going to have something to work on. And the number of drugs coming through any one company is tiny in this area. And therefore, the number of really experienced clinical development teams that any one company can, or any company can afford is very small. We haven't got the proper economies of scale across industry. So there's an issue there, I think, about how industry works together. There's a second question, which is even if you had a great team to do this, the number of hospitals set up to do antibiotic trials is rather limited. There are some changes to that, which I'll come on to. But it's difficult to find the right investigators. It's difficult to get the patients stratified. It's difficult to get those trials actually done. Let me give you an example. Trying to work out how to test a drug in a resistant form of strep pneumonia. In the current system, you'd have to enroll something like 1,000 patients in order to end up with 39 with resistant strep pneumonia. If you could do something diagnostically to reduce that number, if you could be more sure of the patients that they really had a strep pneumonia and secondly they had the resistant form, you could dramatically reduce the cost of this. So it's not just clinical development teams, it's not just the difficulty of networks of hospitals set up to do antibiotic drug research in the clinic, it's also the diagnostic question which has been raised. You end up with so many patients who don't even have the right infection that you dilute the possibility of seeing an effect, and it costs a massive amount of money. So I'm completely supporting the Longitude Prize. That this is a key area. If we can get a diagnostic, this is going to change not only clinical practice, but will change the ability to make a new medicine. The final point on the clinical side is the regulatory process. It's very difficult to get any drug approved. if you apply the standard regulatory process to an antibiotic, you've just introduced a massive hurdle and you've introduced a huge disincentive to do exactly what Jeremy said, which is to do combination studies. The rule of the regulatory authorities is you look at one thing at a time and you have to prove that thing works. It may well be that that thing doesn't work very well on its own. It works very well in combination and it's needed in combination. The system is currently geared against that. Now, having said that, it's absolutely recognised by both the FDA and the European regulatory authorities that this is a problem, and they've gone quite a long way to try and make things very much easier. So they have recognised that. There are fast-tracked paths for approval. There are things that can be done. But let me just give you an example. We are probably, well, not probably, we are the most regulated industry in the world. There's another highly regulated industry, which is the airline industry. There's some quite important differences. There's one set of rules across the globe for the airline industry. When you get in your aeroplane in New York and it lands in Tokyo, you do not need to change the wheels and go to a system that says you're only allowed two engines. You have one set of rules that applies across the globe. We have multiple different sets of regulatory requirements for what is a global problem. And harmonisation of the regulatory process, I think, is a key priority. It's a way in which we could get these drugs through on a global scale without worrying about whether there's one set of comparator drugs, there's one set of processes in one country, another set in another country. It's a big disincentive to have diversified regulatory processes. And that, I believe, again, is something the regulators understand, is something the regulators want to work towards, and I believe is a tractable outcome to try and get that sort of harmonisation in this space. The final point is the issue of return on investment. So we have spent, I think, something like $1 billion in the last 9 years at GSK on antibiotic drug discovery and development. At some point, somebody wants to know what comes out at the other end of that. If I put myself back in the shoes of a practicing clinician, or I think of myself as a member of society, what do I want? I want an antibiotic that is effective against these difficult bugs, and I want it not to be used. I absolutely don't want it widely used. If it is to be used, I want it to be used for an appropriate course, which is normally days rather than weeks or months. And that causes a big problem. So I've spent $1 billion. I make a drug which everyone says, thank you very much, I'd like to have that on the shelf and not use it. And I might need it in 10 years' time. My patent clock started ticking a long time ago, and it's gone. A generic company can copy that like that. It's a massive disincentive to companies to invest in this area, and we need to face up to the fact that it is right that the drugs aren't used, it is right that the courses are short, it is right that there's appropriate stewardship of antibiotics in practice, and yet we need to come up with an incentive to allow companies across the world to think, yes, they want to be in this area and they can see that there'd be a return. I think there are some models, and many people in this room have been involved with thinking about what those models might be to give some incentive to allow people to do antibiotic drug discovery and development. There are things happening, and I think it's important to recognise things are happening. And actually, the first thing to say is I think there are something like 49 chemicals in clinical trials at the moment. So there are antibiotics being looked at. And I agree with Sally, there aren't new classes. There are some in the pipeline coming through, and there may be, you know, one or two new classes in the last decade, and that's it. So we do need new classes. But there are other things as well. So, I mean, there are incentives, particularly in the US. There are a number of systems, both the BARDA and DITRA organisations have given quite significant sums of money to try and help companies make new drugs, and have also looked at things like piggybacking on the use in defence indications to try and give some incentives. So there are some mechanisms, and I think Sally's mentioned this, new drugs for bad bugs, the IMI initiative actually has got quite a lot going across Europe. There's some quite important things, including in the top left there, research in trying to really study this question of how you can stop drugs kicking out, bacteria kicking out drugs, through to clinical trial networks in the bottom left, and indeed the NIH in the US are also doing this, through to different ways of looking at how you actually get the right chemical, and to consortia to look at economic modelling as to what would an incentive be. So that, there is quite a lot of activity here. And I want to end, though, with one thing which really picks up a point that Jeremy made, which I think is crucial, I think is a real UK opportunity, actually, and that is, if I go right back to the beginning, the scientific challenge is one that actually, if you can crack some of that, then the economics of this become very different. So it's true there are incentives needed at the end of the game. There are also some things that I think could be done at the beginning. And one of the key things is moving away from a traditional view of what constitutes a microbial target to be looking at other things, including host targets. How do we actually respond to infections, and how might we boost our defence as a way of treating drugs, treating infections? How do we look at molecules other than the traditional pill, but actually look at antibodies, look at vaccines, looking at bacteriophages, which Jeremy mentioned? And I think there is an opportunity in the UK to bring together academic groups together with industry to say, could we put a centre of excellence to really try and get these sorts of areas progressed to get new targets, which would then make it easier for companies to come in and make medicines? So I do think throughout these three areas, there are practical things that could be done, and I do think there are some specific opportunities in the UK, and I know that's a view that many in academia share as well. Thank you very much.